Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls. Finish up that presentation or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And let's give this opening another shot because I just tried a really corny opening line and Robert's just look of quiet contempt across the table.
No, I was laughing on the inside, you know?
I'm sure you were. I wasn't even laughing at my own joke there. And maybe this will be better. Okay, so we're going to start off today by doing a Charles Darwin deep cut. Darwin, of course, published his great work on the origin of species in 1859. And, of course, that was the book that explained his theory of the origin of species through evolution by natural selection. Then later you got another one. That's The Descent of Man, 1871, which applied his theory to human evolution. And then a year after that, in 1872, he published The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, which is about the biological features of emotions like happiness, sadness, surprise, fear. For example, the relationship between what we feel and the physical expressions of those feelings in the body. Because I think this is one of those little mysteries that's so close and so invisible, we forget to ask why. But why is it that emotions, which are influenced by the content of our thoughts, like our beliefs and our knowledge, what we're aware of, why do they cause these powerful, automatic, even unconscious reactions from the muscles and glands throughout the body? Why does a feeling of moral disgust cause us to involuntarily turn our faces away and crinkle our noses up? Or why does a feeling of embarrassment or passion sometimes cause blood to rush to the cheeks and cause us to cover parts of our faces with our hands? Or why does an emotionally manipulative TV commercial about a sad dog trigger these unconscious movements in the eyebrows and the corners of the mouth or even engage the tear ducts if you're a real sap?
Yes, a sad dog. The dog should be smiling and be happy, right?
Well, there's always like, those are the things that are funny where like, a really dramatically moving, you know, whole movie or book might not make me cry, but like the sentimental commercial with like the old dog buddy and the, you know, buying the Purina one for him or whatever, really like gets me going.
Well, those have been like finely sharpened by, multi-million-dollar marketing campaigns to cut right to the heart.
Yeah, they're emotional assassins. They slip in the night. They're ninja. So I think these relationships between thoughts and feelings and autonomically regulated involuntary activity of the skeletal muscles in the face and elsewhere in the body is truly a fascinating evolutionary mystery. Why do our bodies execute these movements when we feel these things? What biological purpose does it serve? And why do so many of these relationships between feelings and movements of the skeletal muscle, not all, but a lot of them, why do they seem to transcend cultural, national, and linguistic barriers? So I think this whole area is a totally interesting subject, ripe for investigation. But today we wanted to focus on one specific question that arises from Darwin's work here. And to introduce this question, I want to read a passage with a few abridgments from the very end of the book where Darwin writes about some of the implications of his observations about emotions in humans and animals. Quote, "The movements of expression in the face and body, whatever their origin may have been, are in themselves of much importance for our welfare. They serve as the first means of communication between the mother and her infant. She smiles approval and thus encourages her child on the right path, or frowns disapproval. We readily perceive..."
It's yeah, right away. What? Come on, the kid was just born, just already just complete disapproval.
Maybe that's more important later
okay.
on. "We readily perceive sympathy in others by their expression. Our sufferings are thus mitigated and our pleasures increased, and mutual good feeling is thus strengthened. The movements of expression give vividness and energy to our spoken word. They reveal the thoughts and intentions of others more truly than do words, which may be falsified." And then a little bit later, "The free expression by outward signs of an emotion intensifies it. On the other hand, the repression, as far as this is possible, of all outward signs softens our emotions. He who gives way to violent gestures will increase his rage. He who does not control the signs of fear will experience fear in a greater degree. And he who remains passive when overwhelmed with grief loses his best chance of recovering elasticity of mind. These results follow partly from the intimate relation which exists between almost all the emotions and their outward manifestations, and partly from the direct influence of exertion on the heart and consequently on the brain. Even the simulation of an emotion tends to arouse it in our minds. Shakespeare, who from his wonderful knowledge of the human mind ought to be an excellent judge, says, 'Is it not monstrous that this player here,'" and this is a line from Hamlet's soliloquy where he's watching the play and mm-hmm. he's watching the actors and he concludes in the end that the play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. But earlier in the soliloquy, he's watching the actors act and Hamlet thinks, "Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working, all his visage wanned, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing."
You know, this is interesting getting into to acting, because I feel like, maybe this is just me, but I feel like a lot of us, when we watch a well-acted scene, especially in a film, as opposed to a play where you can actually get so much closer to the facial features of the actor, if the actor is truly talented, it's something to behold, watching them channel emotion, sometimes completely non-verbally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it probably stands out for a couple of reasons. For starters, there are a lot of bad or just average performances in film where you don't see authentic emotion channeled, even in like scenes of extreme emotion, which you're going to encounter more often in a film, perhaps than in everyday life. But even in everyday life, when we're encountering someone displaying extreme emotion, we are likely a part of that scenario.
Yeah.
You know, unless we see something on the street. But even then, I mean, unless you're a complete bystander and you're just completely locked out of it, you're probably going to feel something.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Whereas if you're watching just a really well acted scene in a film, like you have that permission of distance, right? Where you can stand back and say, look at what their face is doing. Like, I'm watching blood vessels move. I'm seeing something in their eyes. Like, I'm seeing authentic emotion pour out of their face.
Yeah, it's like watching a film can, especially with great acting, can be like a tasting course for human emotions, whereas normally, like, you know, you'd be involved in the cooking or something, or, right. you know, and so, and of course it would just be rude to try to observe other people's emotions so closely. So, that's a really good point about acting. And it is interesting. I mean, we often wonder this, right? Like, when an actor convincingly portrays an emotion or character, does the actor actually feel that emotion? Mm-hmm. What are the important biological or psychological differences in the moment between an actor acting out an emotion with their face and their body and a person actually feeling that emotion? Like, what are the differences you could name there?
Yeah. I mean, and obviously there are different approaches to acting, different schools of acting. But, certainly a lot of the time when you're seeing somebody emote on the screen, they are drawing on real emotions, real experiences that are in some way comparable to what their character is supposed to feel.
Yeah, and I think that's why a lot of times actors actually need time to, say, get into and out of character. You know, they can't turn it off and on in an instant. I mean, I guess mm-hmm. maybe some can, but a lot can't. They need a few moments to sort of gather themselves to get in and then gather themselves once they get out.
Yeah.
So anyway, Darwin is suggesting here that the bodily manifestations of emotion, including the facial expressions, are not just a consequence of the emotions we feel, though they are that, of course. And the fact that we have these outward signs of the emotions we feel, of course, is useful for communicating our emotional states to others. And this could be one very important biological role that these expressions play. But he says they also are involved in the regulation and maintenance of the emotions themselves. So a smile isn't just a consequence of feeling joy. The smile contributes to and sustains and modulates the feeling of joy. The tightened lip corner isn't just a result of our feeling of contempt, but it in some way makes us feel contempt.
So it's almost like they're two dogs chained to each other. And if one moves, the other one cannot help but be moved as well.
Right. Well, I mean, according to Darwin's view here, yeah. So his idea is that the bodily expressions don't just follow from emotional states. They in part are the emotional states. They contribute to and control the emotional states.
Yeah. Yeah. And, we'll get into this some more, but I think that this is something that a lot of us can point to times in our life where this either definitely feels true, or other times where it definitely doesn't feel true.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, I go to yoga a lot. I really enjoy and I think benefit physically and mentally from a yoga practice. And there are times where you're in a pose, and a teacher may tell everybody, don't forget to smile, and then that'll change your sort of emotional participation with the pose.
Mm-hmm.
And in those situations, it does feel sometimes like it helps. On the other hand, I've had teachers who say that they've stopped saying that because sometimes people in the class, have bad experience with being told to smile. I mean, that's very much
getting harassed on the street.
Yeah,
or something.
A cliche of misogynistic behavior, telling someone they should smile more, telling someone they should smile. And it can be that alone. Yeah, can feel no matter, you know what your gender happens to be. It's like being told to smile as if that is just going to fix your problems. That's going to totally change your mood. It can feel insulting, right? Like surely my emotional state depends on more than just what my face is doing. And ultimately, I think we all can agree it does. Being told to smile and then smiling does not fix whatever caused you to frown to begin with. And then that's not getting into the case, the situation that we do need to frown. We do need to have like the full spectrum of emotions.
Right. That's certainly right, even if Darwin's correct. Like mm-hmm. even if Darwin is right that the smile itself can give you some kind of feedback that in turn actually increases the positivity of your emotional state, the smile can make you happier. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean it's good for other like exogenous forces to try to coerce smiling
right.
on you, to tell you should be smiling, which I think can probably lead to all kinds of other emotions that could negate whatever positivity comes from the muscle movements that might be making you happier.
Right. So as we're talking, we're not talking just about smiles, but mm-hmm. smiles do come up a lot in the discussion here. So I thought it would be helpful to take a moment to just talk about what a smile is.
Mm-hmm.
Our smile is a bit different from the smile that we see expressed by our great ape brethren, where it is essentially a fear grin. You know, it's often flashed when an individual is trapped or threatened. It's a show of submission to more dominant members of the group. And, you know, it is then an admission of fear and a signal, though a signal that doesn't just stand on its own. It's like part of a larger bodily signal that is expressed as if to say, you know, I am not hostile. I am not a threat. And I was reading a little bit about this. Neuroscientist Michael Graziano, who we've discussed on the show before, he has a wonderful Eon Magazine article that discusses this topic. And he points out a number of the things we've talked about here already. He also points out, you know, that even, you know, with humans, people sometimes in subservient positions will smile a lot. You know, there's sort of the boot licking smile that we still kind of identify.
The idea of the obsequious smile.
Yeah. And so that in that it would seem that there are certain aspects of the great ape smile that haven't quite left us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he points as well to Shakespeare, a line from Troilus and Cressida, quote, "They send their smiles before them to Achilles," which I think is rather nice. So the human smile seems to have definitely emerged out of this same sort of thing. I mean, you know, we are primates after all. And of course, even though there, you know, a smile is a smile is a smile, there are some cultural differences in the way smiles are perceived from one culture to another. We've mentioned, or Darwin mentioned babies earlier, and certainly human newborns flash reflex smiles, but then social smiles come a little later, 6 to 12 weeks generally. Anyway, in this Ian article, Graziano points out that, you know, most commentators agree that primate smiles are very old, and some think that it might have evolved out of an older threatening display. But he thinks that if we focus too much on the teeth, we miss something else. Again, that full body display that is evident.
Right. It involves multiple regions of muscles in the face.
Yeah.
I think stuff around the cheeks and the sides of the mouth, but also the eyes, right?
Yeah, yeah. And even, yeah, just like what you know, the full body's doing and the full, you know, communication array that is the face and the head. So what he proposes ultimately is that what we're talking about here is a smile that's kind of a halfway point between not reacting to a display of dominance and fully reacting to it.
Hmm.
Which is interesting. It's almost like you know, these creatures learning to lie to each other, to deceive each other. You know, here's a quote from it where he's talking about like monkey A and monkey B. You know, hypothetically interacting. Quote, "Monkey B can learn a lot by watching the reaction of monkey A. If monkey A makes a full-blown protective response, cringe and all, it's a pretty good sign that monkey A is frightened. He's uneasy. His personal space is revved up and expanded. He must view monkey B as a threat, a social superior. On the other hand, if monkey A reveals only a subtle response, perhaps squinting and slightly pulling back his head, it's a good sign that monkey A is not so frightened. He does not consider monkey B to be a social superior or a threat." So the social signal evolves from here, and he drives home that, quote, "The primary evolutionary pressure is on the receiver of the signal, not the sender. The story is about how we came to react to smiles."
Yeah, that's interesting. But it also raises all these other questions about, so if we consider the evolution of the smile as having something to do with social signaling, it, you know, relates to the social relationships between animals that live in groups and interact with each other, why is it that in our lives, at least, I would say the smile is very divorced from that original context where you smile by yourself all the time.
Yeah.
You be completely alone and something makes you happy and you find yourself beaming.
Yeah, this is true. Now, we've discussed before, though, how we might not laugh, though. We might smile but not laugh, or at least—
That's a good point,
the
yeah.
laughter might be, and the smile might be more pronounced if there's someone else around, particularly, you know, someone we know.
Yeah, we were just talking about this before we started recording, actually, how, you know, we watch the Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode, and we laugh if somebody else is in the room. It's still funny if nobody else is there, but you just don't laugh out loud.
Yeah, I've I'm trying to think of a time if I ever watched something and just really laughed out loud by myself at how funny it is. Like, nothing comes to mind. And in fact, I think I would feel weird if I did. I would feel like Sam Neill's character at the end of In the Mouth of Madness, where he's in the movie theater.
Sometimes barbarian movies do it for me. I think I was laughing pretty loud by myself when I was watching Your Hunter from the Future.
Now, maybe you were just beside yourself with laughter, and therefore, yeah. You know, you have you know yourself to communicate to. So basically, Graziano points out, you know, that from here it would have been an evolutionary arms race. And this is a wonderful article, by the way. It's titled "The First Smile." It's available, at EN Magazine, and he gets into laughter as well. But here's how he sums everything up: "Quote: Evolution favors animals that can read and react to those signs, and it favors animals that can manipulate those signs to influence whoever is watching. We have stumbled on the defining ambiguity of human emotional life. We are always caught between authenticity and fakery, always floating in the gray area between involuntary outburst and expedient pretense."
Oh, that's well put.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's helpful to think about the complexity of the smile, the mix of authenticity and fakery. We've discussed fake smiles on the show before about how, you know, there's this lack of micro-expressive detail in a fake smile that you can pick up on, but that to, like, truly fake a smile, you do have to summon some of the energy of the smile, you know?
Uh-huh.
It gets very complicated, especially in the human scenario, to define exactly what a smile is and the degrees of smiling.
Well, here's maybe a good question. Are all smiles on command fake smiles? Mm-hmm. Or are there cases where you smile on command and not because, you know, you suddenly are overwhelmed by a feeling of positivity and joy and happiness? You know, you just smile because you need to, but it's not fake.
Yeah, this is a good question. It kind of goes in with laughter as well, or at least kind of like the mild laughter. I think of like interactions with people, be it at work or, you know, strangers at a store, you know, the various social interactions that fill our lives. And I'll catch myself smiling. I'll catch myself, you know, laughing a little bit, even if there's not a joke, which seems strange. Like maybe it makes me kind of feel like I'm the Joker or something.
The man who laughs.
Yeah. Yeah. Not in the good way, not in the Steve Miller way, but, you know, in the Batman way. And you start teasing it apart and you start asking yourself, well, was this authentic? Was this inauthentic? Or is it like Graziano says, is it somewhere in between? Like, for instance, I think one person wrote into us once and accused one or both of us of fake laughing at each other's jokes. Do you remember this?
I don't remember this.
And, it was a while back. And I think it was only one person that ever wrote in about it. And it just made me stop and think, though, because I'm like, well, what we do here is kind of a performance, you know? We're not reading from a script. We're having an authentic conversation, but it's a conversation knowing that someone else is listening to it.
Uh-huh.
And like we do make each other laugh,
yeah.
But maybe we do lean into it a little bit. I don't know. It basically comes down to exactly what Graziano said, that it's not just fakery and authenticity, but there's this huge area in between, and we may not even be aware of where we are on that spectrum in a given moment.
Okay, I think we got to take a break, but we will be right back with more.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier, connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
All right, we're back.
Okay, so we've been discussing facial expressions, emotions, Darwin's writing on the relationship between facial expressions and emotions, or not just facial expressions, I mean all kinds of body expressions and physical manifestations and emotions. And so this leads up to something that we're going to be talking about for the rest of today's episode, which has come to be known as the facial feedback hypothesis. Now, I guess to have a starting place, we should talk about what some of the acceptable emotions for discussions are, because obviously there are lots of complex emotions that might be, you know, little shadings of other more basic emotions or combinations of feelings. Commonly acknowledged basic emotions in psychology as categorized by the American psychologist Paul Ekman. Let's hear him. How about happiness?
Okay.
Sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Disgust, anger, and fear. There you got your big six. Now, other psychologists have offered slightly different lists, but I think this seems to be like a good starting place. These are like six widely acknowledged basic emotions, setting aside for a second that, you know, different theories of what emotions actually are, which we'll come back to later in the episode. They're also like the constructionist ideas of emotions, which says it's more like there's some kind of universal slider underneath all these, and these are like categories that we apply to where that slider is. But for now, we're going to work with those kind of six emotions. And so put succinctly, the facial feedback hypothesis is the idea that, quote, an individual's experience of emotion is influenced by feedback from their facial movements. Now, there are tons of different versions of this hypothesis that have been articulated and tested over the years. We'll get more into those differences later on. We know Darwin proposed something like this in the 1870s, and it's been advocated by other important figures in intellectual history. The seminal American psychologist William James argued in his 1890 work on psychology that at least for the more basic or coarser emotions, emotions, in a way, simply are identical with the sensation of their physical manifestations in the body. Quote, if we fancy some strong emotion and then try to abstract from our consciousness of it all the feelings of its bodily symptoms, we find we have nothing left behind, no mind stuff out of which the emotion can be constituted, and that a cold and neutral state of intellectual perception is all that remains. So this is a strange idea, but this did hold some sway for a long time. It's the idea that the feeling of an emotion is the feeling of changes happening in the body, including but not limited to the skeletal muscle. And this would center largely but not entirely on expressions that happen automatically in the facial muscles, but also all throughout the body.
Well, you know, this does remind me that, you know, when one is smiling intensely,
mm-hmm.
Organically, you know, you're not faking it at all, but like something is making you really smile and perhaps laugh really hard as well,
mm-hmm.
there is a feeling of possession about it.
Yeah.
Where you could imagine it's like this, the physical you know, symptoms are actually kind of like crunching your brain into this pattern of thinking.
Uh-huh.
Like you are happy now. You are laughing now.
Do you ever get the feeling of like feeling happiness in the face, in the way that if the emotion has a location, it kind of feels like it's somewhere behind the face? And
kind of, or like it's a claw, like it's like a claw clamped over the face, like a xenomorph claw, you know, an alien. And then you get to the point where your face is hurting a little bit. Like that is always a weird sensation where you're like, I'm so happy and overcome by joy and it's physically hurting me. I wish it would stop.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, other emotions, I think we often, do you not, at least I do, associate fear with a feeling in the stomach and the gut? Do you not associate sadness with kind of feelings in like the throat and the temples and behind the face also?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, with that being, you know, it's often like there's a, like a nasal activation, you know, we often don't want to think about that when we think about, you know, weeping tears of joy, but it's often not just tears of joy, it's snot of joy or snot of sadness, but it's not nearly as poetic, but that's how it works. And in terms of like fear and, you know, anxiety, I often think of it as more like a claw. Again, I guess it's claws. Like I can't get past the claws, but it is more of an internal claw clutching not the face but the heart.
Uh-huh. I had no idea your psychic universe was all claws.
Yeah, I mean I guess that's how I view the outside world. It's just a series of claws trying to get to the heart of me.
So William James also, like Darwin, addressed the subject of acting. So to defend this idea, he brings up a hypothetical objection to his argument. It goes something like this. So William James, you say that bodily expressions of an emotion are identical to the feeling of the emotion. Wouldn't it follow then that an actor faking an emotion is exactly the same as somebody really feeling it? And the way James phrases this is that any voluntary cold-blooded arousal of the so-called manifestations of a special emotion ought to give us the emotion itself. And James answers this objection by saying, first of all, you can't really test this because a lot of the bodily manifestations of emotions are in organs that we can't voluntarily control, things in the, you know, in the gut, in the autonomic nervous system. He gives the example of tears. Most people can't cry on command. Thus, they can't actually perform a voluntary cold-blooded arousal of the physical manifestations in the body. But there are some cases where we can control those manifestations. And in these cases, James says, the problem with the objection is that it just assumes it's obviously wrong that cold-blooded arousal of the manifestations gives us the emotion itself. He does not concede that this is an absurdity. Instead, he writes, quote, "Everyone knows how panic is increased by flight, and how giving way to the symptoms of grief or anger increases those passions themselves. Each fit of sobbing makes the sorrow more acute and calls forth another fit stronger still, until at last repose only ensues with lassitude and with the apparent exhaustion of the machinery. In rage, it is notorious how we work ourselves up to a climax by repeated outbreaks of expression. Refuse to express a passion and it dies." This is a famous quote here. "Count 10 before venting your anger and its occasion seems ridiculous. Whistling to keep up courage is no mere figure of speech. On the other hand, sit all day in a moping posture, sigh and reply to everything with a dismal voice and your melancholy lingers. There's no more valuable precept in moral education than this, as all who have experience know. If we wish to conquer undesirable emotional tendencies in ourselves, we must assiduously, and in the first instance cold-bloodedly, go through the outward movements of these contrary dispositions which we prefer to cultivate." So this is sort of the origin of fake it till you make it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or telling people to smile and they'll be happier too. I mean, it's... he puts it so well, and my response is both yes and no. Like, you know, this feels absolutely true, but also like, you know, so many different objections pop up as well. I mean, for starters, just the idea of like refuse to express a passion and it dies. I mean, that runs counter to a lot of, at least, you know, certainly to the advice that is often given about passions and how we should not bury them inside of us, because it won't die if it is buried inside us, that it will find a way out. And it might not find its way out in a way, or at least at a time that is that is beneficial.
Well, I am also of two minds about this. And the idea of, refuse to express a passion and it dies. I think I've talked on the podcast before about how I'm often skeptical of the benefits of what people call venting.
Yeah.
Though at the same time, I don't think it's good to, have strong feelings about something and have nobody to talk to them about. When you can't talk about something that is psychologically stressful, it's a burden on you. And so, on one hand, you do need to be able to talk about things, but there's this thing people call venting, which is like, something is bothering them and they just continually express their frustration in a kind of repetitive pattern about it.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to notice throughout my life that this, in myself and in others, this doesn't actually make you feel better. The venting process, I think most of the time, just makes you madder and madder. You work yourself up into a state where the problem assumes a larger posture than it did to begin with.
And you're talking about speaking aloud, that sort of venting, because it seems like that sort of venting has a lot in common with the things that go on inside the mind and the default mode network. As we ruminate over something, some worry, we kind of rehearse for disasters, for example, or we essentially fantasize about terrible things occurring, and it's kind of the same practice, right? I mean, it's filling your mind with some sort of negative outcome, be it you yelling at somebody or bad things happening to you, kind of rehearsals for disaster.
Yeah, the psychological process of rumination, where you just rehearse the worst possible scenarios in your mind over and over again, is terrible.
But then the idea here, though, is there could be a feedback loop. If you're expressing it bodily or facially, then it's just going to potentially make things worse.
Yeah, and I do think to some extent that's true. So obviously we're dealing with something that's very complicated, and that's not a surprise because it involves emotions. I think emotions are, we'll go ahead and say today, emotions are one of the most difficult things to study scientifically, I think. And so studies about them are often plagued with problems of inconsistency in how the emotions are characterized, how they're measured, how exactly do you quantify emotional states. It's one of the most difficult problems in all of science, I think.
Yeah, how do you even agree on the basic terminology? And then if you end up creating something that seems like a useful explanation, is it ultimately just kind of a system of metaphors to try and make sense of this thing? It's kind of like the Pixar movie Inside Out.
Oh, I hadn't seen it.
Wonderful movie about emotions. But ultimately, there are not a series of individuals inside of your head arguing with each other and going on adventures. So you worry too about to what extent you end up going too far in one of these directions and really trying to apply language to the unlanguaged complexity of the mind.
But obviously, then again, emotions are one of the most important features of our entire lives. So psychology should be taking a crack at understanding them. And so I guess that brings us back to this question of the facial feedback hypothesis. If it's true that movements of the facial muscles or facial expressions do contribute to our underlying emotional states. They don't just follow from them, but they feed back into them and in some way control them. Is there evidence for that? Is there evidence that that's true? And I guess that's what we should discuss next. So one thing we absolutely do not lack for is studies on this subject. The facial feedback hypothesis is huge, and it's a very complicated subject with a massive and conflicting research history. There's no way to discuss all these studies, but in a minute we will be looking at a recent meta-analysis paper that sort of gives an overview of these findings. Now, one thing is problems with methodology we were just alluding to in how you study things like the relationship between facial expressions and emotions. Of course, you can just ask people to smile or frown or do things with their face and then ask them how they feel. But these kinds of experiments would have some obvious limitations, right? If people are aware of being asked to smile, this knowledge could change how they report their feelings and it could bias the results. You could have acquiescence bias where, you know, people in an experiment tend to just sort of try to figure out what the experimenters want and give them those types of results. Mm-hmm. Or more generally, what are referred to as demand characteristics, where things emerge in the research environment that would not emerge naturally. So different tests devised over the years have tried to get around this a number of ways, trying to like contort the facial muscles and see if that does something to emotional states without just saying, hey, you know, could you please frown for a minute and then we're going to ask you to do a questionnaire. Mm. So like one type of thing is the pin in the mouth study.
Oh, yes.
So here's one where you put a pin either between your lips or you put a pin between your teeth. When you put a pin between your lips, it just happens to form your face into a frown. When you put a pin between your teeth, it happens to induce the same muscles that you would use in a smile. So that's been used in a number of studies. Another thing is like asking participants to say a lot of certain vowels. For example, ah sounds incidentally produce smile posture, and ooh sounds incidentally produce frown posture. And some research has found, for example, that ah sounds make people self-report more happy or pleasant feelings. And I've even seen this connected to the prevalence of ah sounds in religious chants. I thought that's kind of an interesting idea there.
Like hallelujah kind
well,
of thing?
Well, all kinds of – I mean, that ah sounds are more prevalent around the world in religious chants than ooh sounds. And this could be because they induce more pleasant mental states.
Hmm. Now, where does om fall then? I guess, well, hopefully om would be between the two, right?
Yeah, maybe. But out of this huge history of all these different studies, just this year we got this big meta-analysis pulled together, tabulating 138 different studies on the effect. It was by Nicholas A. Coles, Jeff T. Larson, and Heather C. Lynch, published in Psychological Bulletin in 2019. And so, okay, you might think that given that many studies, 138 studies, now we should have a really solid body of evidence converging on a clear consensus answer. And in one broad sense, that's true, and in many more specific senses, it's not true. To quote the authors here, "Unfortunately, more than a century's worth of research has not yet clarified whether facial feedback effects are reliable. For example, researchers have produced a variety of theoretical disagreements about when facial feedback effects should emerge, but it remains unclear which, if any, of these theories are correct. Furthermore, 17 labs recently found that even the most seminal demonstration of facial feedback effects is not clearly replicable." Mm. And this was a big problem. So, like one of the biggest studies, it was a pin in the mouth study that found that, you know, putting a pin between the teeth made people report more happy emotions than putting it between the lips. That was big. But then just recently, a bunch of labs tried to replicate it and they couldn't. So here's this big question. What all these studies add up to? So here's where this new meta-analysis comes in. Quote, "Amid this uncertainty, we provide a narrative review of research on the facial feedback hypothesis and a meta-analysis of all available experimental evidence." So they're pulling all the studies together and trying to see if they can crunch the numbers and figure out what is shown overall. So I think maybe we should take another break, and then when we come back, we can get into the results of this study.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier, connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
All right, we're back. So, yeah, we're looking at a meta-analysis of all of these different studies about facial feedback hypothesis. And hopefully, like, some sense will emerge from it all, right? We'll have some general ideas that we can draw from it, right?
We will get some. There are other things that are left unanswered. So one of the things is that we alluded to all these different problems in how you study something like the facial feedback hypothesis. Like, the authors identify four major theoretical disagreements in how people even approach the subject to begin with. I'll try to simplify them as briefly as I can. One is modulation versus initiation, okay? So one view says that emotions are maintained and modulated by body expression. So you're genuinely happy, you're feeling happy, and that makes you smile. And then the smile can maintain and intensify the happiness, or suppressing the smile can put a damper on the happiness. This is the modulation hypothesis. Meanwhile, the other view would say that at least some emotions can be created out of nothing with facial feedback alone. So maybe you're feeling neutral, but you make yourself frown for 5 minutes and you actually end up feeling sad. This is the initiation hypothesis. Hmm. Though the authors note something interesting here that maybe we wouldn't have thought about otherwise. They note that this distinction assumes that emotional experiences have a beginning and an ending, that they are discrete rather than continuous and always in flux. Like, if you feel happy, can you pinpoint the moment when you started feeling happy? And was there no happiness before? Or was it just something that got turned up in amplitude but was there before? This is an interesting question. Like, are emotions discrete things that can begin and end? Or are they part of a continuous media that's always in flux with maybe, and of course, if they are, there's maybe no difference between initiation and modulation.
Yeah, it makes me think, is like a flow state a non-emotional state?
Hmm. I've never heard it put like that. I'd have to think about that.
Because generally when I think about being in a flow state, I think about it being happiness because, like, it's you're content. You're not, you know, you're totally wrapped up in the task at hand and you're not, thinking about anything else. But then again, is it really happiness or is it, like, just sort of removal from the wheel of emotions to some extent?
Disengaging from the default mode network, yeah. That's for sure. And the default mode network sometimes just seems like kind of a roulette wheel of emotions, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's just spin it and let's just see what the universe has for me right now. Am I going to be happy in the next minute or sad? It's like I often feel like I have no idea.
And for me, it's like, which of your failures would you like to contemplate?
Yeah, default mode.
Okay, so next, you've got discrete versus dimensional emotional experience. So are happiness, anger, sadness, all that, are they discrete categories? Do these basic emotions exist as sort of separate programs within the brain? Or can they all be reduced to some underlying phenomena presenting at different levels of intensity and valence? So the basic idea here is, like, imagine you got a couple of sliders in your brain. One is a slider that's the valence. Is this positive or negative? Mm-hmm. And then the other slider is the level of arousal. Are you high arousal or low arousal? And those two sliders positioned at different places actually give you the things you think of as your normal emotions. The names of the emotions are just sort of like categories that we apply based on contextual clues. That's a possibility.
Yeah, I was thinking a little about this yesterday because I was working on another episode's notes, and I was listening to a little Jackson Browne. I was playing Fountain of Sorrow.
Okay.
And I had to stop. It's like, because I was thinking, is this song making me feel good or bad? Is it making me happy or sad? It's like, but it's neither. You know, it's this mix of both. Like, it's a kind of a sad, bittersweet song that's beautifully recorded, and I have, you know, nostalgia for it, but it's also, you know, it's complicated.
Yeah, there are a lot of moments where you can start to wonder if this is, I think, sometimes called like the constructionist or core affect idea of emotions, where they're not these discrete programs running in the brain, but they're the same thing. They're the same part of the same continuous quantity, and we just like apply categories to different zones on this graph, basically. And depending on what the contextual clues are, because one level of high arousal and negative emotion in one state might feel like, you know, like anger and agitation, and in another state it might be more like sadness, intense sadness. But obviously, you know, I don't know which of these theories of emotion is the correct one. But that's another thing that's at play in all these studies. People are working off different theories of emotion when they're trying to study whether emotions can be modulated or caused by facial movements. Next big question, is awareness involved? If facial feedback does influence our emotions, do you have to be consciously aware of the face you're making or how you're moving your muscles? Like, I feel myself smiling. I know that smiles mean happiness, so I feel happy. Or do these facial movements, if the facial feedback hypothesis is correct, do these facial movements influence our emotions unconsciously through, you know, through feedback mechanisms that happen outside of our awareness?
Huh. Well, in my experience, for whatever that's worth, I find that being aware of your happiness is one surefire way to potentially bring it down, you know?
That's a good point, you
know?
Yeah.
Like, so, but then again, I don't know how that actually, you know, relates to any of the research here.
Well, it's hard to think yourself happy, but it's pretty easy to think yourself sad.
Yeah.
Now, one thing we mentioned earlier is, like, some of those studies are aimed at trying to show that the effect happens without conscious awareness, like the pin in the mouth study, right? Mm-hmm. If you put a pin between people's teeth and that makes them feel happier, obviously they're not going to be aware of the fact that they're smiling. They've just got a pin in their teeth. So that for what, and there were studies that showed something like that, I think back in the 1980s. However, that was the study that failed replication in recent years. So people tried to do the experiment again, didn't get the same result. That means that either there was something wrong with the initial experiment or with all the replication attempts, or they could both be sound, but arriving at different results because there's some important difference that's not being controlled for there. So that's something I don't know the answer to yet. I think I saw there might be a study that was trying to resolve whatever difference was going on there, but I didn't have time to look into that. One more big question. Does facial feedback have an effect on affective judgments? So not just how you feel, but what you think about other things, you know, third parties. What do you think about this cup? What do you think about this microphone? I'm sorry that a cup is so often an example that we invoke on in the moment here in
it's
the studio.
It's one of our few props in here. It's true.
It's either going to be that or the foam soundproofing board. So, but what do you think about these things? So if our facial expressions modulate our emotions, do they do just that? Or do they also change the ways that we make judgments about these external objects, people, and situations? And the authors call this the affective judgments hypothesis. Does frowning make you view another person more negatively? So obviously all these theoretical disagreements make a meta-analysis of the facial feedback hypothesis really difficult because despite how many studies there are now, they're not all testing exactly the same thing. They're not all working from the same theoretical framework. So the authors had to like code for all these differences in what's being tested in each study, as well as lots of other moderators, including how the facial feedback was manipulated. For example, you know, the pin in the teeth, or just asking people to do a facial pose, or even experimenting with people who have had Botox injections that restrict facial movement. That's an interesting one. Yeah. And then other moderators like the timing of measurement, the gender, for example. Some earlier research had found that maybe men were more susceptible to body feedback on average than women, and whether subjects were aware of being video recorded and things like that. All right, so time for the results. I would say the top line here is that some facial feedback effects seem to be real, but the effect is not huge. The overall body of research suggests that the effect is real, it is significant, but it's relatively small, and it's variable based on a lot of different things, like on these theoretical disagreements and moderating variables that we mentioned earlier. So just a few key selections from the specifics of the results. One is this question about initiation versus modulation, right? Can facial feedback only influence pre-existing emotions, or can it actually create new emotional experiences from a starting neutral state? And the evidence shows it can definitely do both. In fact, contrary to many historical predictions and assumptions, the initiation of emotions through facial posing is pretty well supported by evidence and seems to be pretty easy to demonstrate. So it's not just the modulation of what you're already feeling. They've shown a bunch of times now that you can just take people, make them do a facial pose, and it does sort of generate an emotion from out of nowhere. However, there is more evidence for some emotions than others. Like there is evidence of a small facial feedback effect for most emotions, but not for a couple of key ones, surprise and fear.
Interesting.
So people who make a happy face, the evidence shows, on average, will tend to feel more happy. But if you make a surprised face or a fearful face, there is not yet good evidence that you will feel those two emotions. Though the authors caution this conclusion because they say there aren't a whole lot of studies on the feedback effect for fear and surprise. Somehow I can really see how this would be the case for surprise. I don't know how you could simulate surprise just by putting a surprise face on. Surprise seems so much more really dependent on actual facts of your surroundings.
Yeah, I wonder if part of this might be that they're just, you know, if we go back to, you know, what I was talking about with Graziano and his, you know, monkey A and monkey B scenario. Like, is there ever a necessity to fake surprise? I mean, certainly if there's a surprise birthday party and you knew about it and you're like, oh, yeah, or
right.
You're...
But you're, people suck at that, right?
Yeah, I mean, we do. Like, when you... I think most of us, if we were asked to fake surprise, we would have a hard time doing anything convincing, you know? Like, it's generally the kind of thing where, again, it's a surprise party that you knew about, or you're humoring, like, a child's, you know, game of scaring you or something. Whereas faking, you know, these other emotions would have much more advantage and are much, you know, more a part of the human emotional deception tool chest.
Yeah, I think that's right. Though I just do want to reiterate again their caution that this may just be because there are fewer studies on these emotions. And we don't know that in a really strong way, but the evidence for those two emotions is not as strong as it is for all the others.
Right. Like, I don't know that I've ever been, though, accused of faking fear, you know? Like, no one's ever written into the show and said, I don't think you were really afraid when you were talking about this particular frightening concept. I think you were faking your fear.
I've never thought about this before, but what emotion is most often acted badly in movies? Hmm. What emotion are people the worst at trying to portray in a fictional scenario?
Oh, man. I've seen them all done poorly, and it can be spectacular in any case. I mean, with fear and surprise, you know, we can certainly think to really affect, like, when it's done well through whatever acting method is employed, like, it really sticks in your mind. It's a reason that how many of us right now are thinking of Donald Sutherland from the Invasion of the Body Snatchers film? You know, it's such an iconic cinematic, you know, moment of just absolute fear, right?
But a lot of directors actually go out of their way to create real surprises on sets for the actors when they want to get a truly shocked and surprised response. Like, I'm thinking of the scene in Alien where the thing bursts out of John Hurt's chest. The first time the actors didn't know exactly what was going to happen in that scene. I think they thought something was going to happen, mm-hmm. but they didn't have all the details. I think an important thing that Ridley Scott was going for there was trying to make sure that they got a real look of shock on their faces. Hmm. Maybe because even though they were all great actors, he didn't trust them enough with surprise.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of different filmmaking stories about that, right? Where you end up having this rift between the actors and the director because the director assumes that they need to pull some sort of stunt to get that kind of emotion out of them. Was it The Exorcist where there were allegations or stories about him like firing like a firearm being discharged on the set to make all the actors be on edge?
Yeah, there are a lot of bad stories about the production of The Exorcist. Okay. We got to get back to this. So a couple more things in the results. Is awareness necessary? Do you have to be aware that you're expressing an emotion on your face for the expression to influence your feelings? The results did not demonstrate that you have to be aware, but they also don't disconfirm there might be some role for self-perception in some cases.
Okay.
Do facial movements influence affective judgments, judging other things? The authors found that this question, unlike the general question of facial feedback, suffered from publication bias. And that's, of course, when studies confirming an effect are more likely to be published than the same studies if they had disconfirmed the effect. When that bias was corrected for, the results did not yet indicate strong evidence for facial expressions changing affective judgment. However, the authors caution against abandoning this line of inquiry because this one could be highly context dependent. They point out that there's some other research in psychology that suggests emotions only change our judgments about external stimuli in some contexts, maybe like when emotion seems relevant to the thing you're judging. Hmm. More research is needed here, to invoke a cliche. But then they also talk about how their findings interact with some competing psychological theories on the nature of emotion, like we talked about earlier. This question of are emotions like happiness and anger and fear discrete programs within the brain, or are they contextual categorizations of different variations of intensity and valence with this more basic core affect? And the results of the meta-analysis show that facial feedback can influence not only reports of basic emotions, but dimensional reports that would be in line with the theory of emotions more based on core affect. So facial feedback doesn't really solve this question. As best I can tell, it could be consistent with either way of looking at what emotions are. They also found that results even within the same categories were fairly variable, suggesting that there were influences on these effects that are not recorded in the data and that they weren't able to test. And one example they give of what this might be is perhaps facial feedback effects are stronger in populations that are on average more, quote, attentive to their bodily cues, including but not limited to proprioceptive cues from the face. Now, of course, proprioception is our sensation. We have more than five senses, right? Mm. It's one of the body senses that lets us know where the parts of our body are. It's how you can know where your hands are even when your eyes are closed. It's this part of this proprioceptive sense. And this could be an influencing factor, but the studies, of course, haven't tried to record or measure this. And I take this to mean that people who have stronger senses of interoception in general, the sensations within their own bodies, those people might be more sensitive to feelings created by the movements of the muscles in their face. And they also cite maybe different exclusion criteria on different studies could have influenced why some of the results are so variable. But they say in the end that, quote, the cumulative evidence to date suggests that facial feedback does indeed influence emotional experience, given all the caveats we just talked about. So I think that's interesting. So, like, what are some takeaways from this? Number one, we don't know yet when and why the effects will be largest. And in general, the effects are real, but kind of small. Though you could see how this knowledge could be applied to some kind of therapeutic uses, I think we probably don't know enough about it to use it most effectively that way yet. But say if you are trying to test and see, you know, could I make myself feel better by just making my face smile? Mm-hmm. It's at least one of those things where I think the risks and downsides associated with trying that out are probably extremely low.
Right. I mean, especially if you're not, to come back to the yoga example, Like if one does experiment with smiling during certain poses, like you're also doing all the yoga. You're doing the, you know, there's also the experience of say, you know, working with the teacher, of being in the space. There are all these other factors that are contributing, and you're not going to make or break it necessarily by engaging in this smiling exercise.
Yeah.
Likewise, I should point out though that there are other things that exercises that one does with your face that could possibly play a role here. Being, like, for instance, just moving your face around in odd ways, or making what is referred to as lion face, where you just make an exaggerated, like, you know, childish, cartoonish monster face out of your own face.
Uh-huh.
And, like, that can be kind of a way of potentially just, like, clearing whatever is physically going on with your face that could be exerting this mild influence on your emotional disposition.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be surprised if there could be like a making monster faces in the mirror therapy kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like you make your monster faces in the mirror, and then there's some kind of change in the emotional centers of the brain caused by these facial muscle movements.
Yeah. Yeah. Like maybe it is a signaling, I mean, to get back to the lion thing, maybe it is some sort of like dominance and aggression that is relayed. Or maybe it's simply like your brain is not that familiar with it. Like, do I ever make lion face the rest of the time in my life? I don't think I really do. So maybe I don't have like a bunch of, you know, emotional material just like lined up for that particular facial feature.
Yeah. And so I would emphasize again, like obviously we don't know how effective this could be in the long run. At like, say you were trying to do something really serious, like battle depression or something.
Yeah.
We're not necessarily saying this is the fix because, again, the effects are small. We don't know exactly how effective it would be at that kind of thing, or what ways you could manipulate the scenario to make it more effective. But like I said, this is something that does seem like a very low risk kind of thing to try if you are trying to manipulate your own moods and emotions. And certainly much, you know, lower risk than a lot of the things people actually do to try to regulate their emotions, like self-medicating with drugs and alcohol and all that.
Right. Yeah. And of course, you know, again, I do want to come back to the fact that there are cultural differences in the way that we use smiles and react to smiles.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's always something to keep in mind as well. Like, is it a given culture where smiling is done more, a given culture or even a given individual where smiling when embarrassed is more of a typical feature?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how would that influence any of this?
Yeah, I'm sure that could contribute. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also thinking about like the full body scenario we were talking about earlier with the hypothetical apes reacting to each other. Like if you're dealing with a smile and it's just, you know, in some of these experiments and it's just isolated to the face, is that truly the expression, or should the smile be part of a like a broader physical manifestation?
Well, another thing that makes me think of is this came up a little bit when we were thinking about the idea of research that used people who had Botox injections
yes.
in the face
mm-hmm.
To see if that affected their emotional cognition. This makes me think more generally about the relationship between skeletal muscle in the face and throughout the body, and our emotional states, and whether there could be relationships there that we don't fully understand yet, but mm-hmm. that how you use your body contributes to your state of mind.
Absolutely. But, you know, the great thing about all this is that this is a wonderful area for individual experience and feedback on this episode. Like, everybody out there has experience with emotions. And
have you ever smiled?
Have you ever smiled? Have you ever frowned? Like, I mean, we've discussed cultural differences and individual differences, so I would love to hear some details about that from folks out there. What are your experiences with being told to smile? What are your experiences with, say, being encouraged to smile during yoga? Or laughter yoga is a whole other area. I mean, we're talking more about laughter than just smiling alone there, but that's very much a situation where the idea is pretend to laugh until you are laughing.
Uh-huh.
And I've tried it a few times, and I find that it works to like a reasonable degree. Like, I don't feel like laughter has possessed me bodily, like there's some sort of a demon leeching into me. But I do find myself.
Is that what you're looking for?
Well, I don't know. Not that I'm necessarily looking for it, but I've seen people overcome with laughter in scenarios like that. Like mm-hmm. basically, when I was in high school, I think I visited a church with a friend where they were doing some form of faith healing. I'm not sure what the terminology is for it, but where an individual would be touched by the pastor. Mm-hmm. And instead of just simply falling to the floor, being healed of their ailment, they would begin laughing hysterically. Mm-hmm. That was the physical manifestation of being touched with the Holy Spirit or whatever the description was. Mm-hmm. So I guess I was kind of, I could not help but think of that when engaging in laughter yoga. Mm. So I just want to drive home that my experience was not a situation of being overcome by, out of control laughter. But then again, the priming wasn't there for that to be the case either. Mm-hmm. So, it could be a situation where if I were entering into it and people were saying, yeah, we're going to do laughter yoga and you're going to lose control of your body, then perhaps I would be more inclined to fall into that scenario. Laughter's weird is what I'm saying.
It is.
It is weird.
Yeah. It's something we can come back to again.
So, if you have any tidbits from your life that you would like to share with us, let us know. In the meantime, check out stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes. And we want to remind you, if you want to support this show, the best thing you can do is tell your friends about it. Share the episodes with people you know, but also rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. So wherever you get this podcast, throw us some stars, leave a nice comment. It really helps us out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison, and to our guest producer today, Maya Cole. If you would like to get in touch with us today with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.